Good morning, everyone, and welcome once again to the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Calgary. I'm the Reverend Derwin Kostanak, the priest of the parish, and I would also like to offer you a Merry Christmas one more time. Now, how can I get away with that? Isn't Christmas over? Well, it's true. Christmas Day has come and gone, but according to the liturgical calendar, the season of Christmas is actually 12 days long. This is the 10th day of the Christmas season. You might recall that there's a song that goes along with that. On the 10th day of Christmas, my true love gave to me, right? This is where it comes from. The Christmas season ends this Wednesday, January 6th, which will be called the Epiphany, according to the church calendar. So until then, we are still exploring the theme of Christmas, the theme of the Incarnation, contemplating what it means that Jesus Christ was born to us. And so, on this second Sunday after Christmas, that is what we will continue to do. And so I'm glad you've tuned in this morning, and I invite you now to listen as we hear the readings, and then as we explore a theme in our sermon this morning. A reading from the book of Sirach. Wisdom praises herself and tells of her glory in the midst of her people. In the assembly of the Most High, she opens her mouth. And in the presence of his host, she tells of her glory. I came forth from the mouth of the Most High and covered the earth like a mist. I dwelt in the highest heavens, and my throne was in a pillar of cloud. Alone I compassed the vault of heaven and traversed the depths of the abyss. Over waves of the sea, over all the earth, and over every people and nation, I have held sway. Among all these, I sought a resting place. In whose territory should I abide? Then the Creator of all things gave me a command, and my Creator chose the place for my tent. He said, "Make your dwelling in Jacob, and in Israel receive your inheritance. Before the ages, in the beginning, he created me, and for all the ages I shall not cease to be. In the holy tent I ministered before him, and so I was established in Zion. Thus, in the beloved city, he gave me a resting place, and in Jerusalem was my domain. I took root in an honored people, in the portion of the Lord, his heritage." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. A reading from the Gospel according to John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and that life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. There was a man sent from God, whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify to the light, so that all might believe through him. He himself was not the light, but he came to testify to the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world came into being through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to what was his own, and his own people did not accept him. But to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood or of the will of the flesh or of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and lived among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. John testified to him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks ahead of me because he was before me.'" From his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. The law indeed was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. It is God the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known. The Gospel of Christ. One of the interesting things as we contemplate the Christmas story is the idea that Jesus' arrival as that baby in that manger in Bethlehem, somehow had an impact on all the world. I mean, think about that for a minute. When Jesus shows up, he is a Palestinian Jewish baby born in a very small part of the world. And throughout his entire life, he never leaves the boundaries of Israel. How is it that his birth affects everybody else in the world? Just by way of contemplating this, the entire time that Jesus was doing his thing throughout his life, as he started as a baby and grew and then was a young man and then started his work of healing and teaching and preaching and proclaiming and all of this, his death, his resurrection, his ascension, all of that took place in the Middle East. While at the same time, the Chinese were living out their history completely oblivious to anything that he was doing. First Nations in what would be called the New World in a couple, almost 2,000 years later, they were doing their thing, completely oblivious to what was happening in the Middle East. How is it that the birth of Jesus Christ there had an impact somehow in China and in North America and even today? That's a good question to contemplate. It's certainly worthy of the season of Christmas. And we are going to do that by looking at these two passages that we have read from the Bible. Now, I have to say a few words about that from the outset, because you will recall that the first reading was from the book of Sirach. And chances are good that you might not know what that book is. Over the years, as the church was understanding which texts they wanted to use, which texts were to be deemed scriptural, the ones that they could follow and take as some kind of authority in terms of how we are to live our Christian life, we are familiar with the 66 books of what we currently call the Old Testament and New Testament. 39 in the Old Testament, 27 in the New Testament. But there were a number of other books that have also been used by the church down through the years. Depending on how you count them, there are up to 18 of these books, and they are referred to usually as the Apocrypha, or sometimes the Deuterocanonical books. These books, in various combinations, are still held to be scriptural by the Roman Catholic Church and by the Orthodox churches. But at the time of the Protestant Reformation, about 500 years ago, a number of Protestants were starting to question whether these books ought to be used. And by the time we get to the 1800s, most Protestant Bibles do not include these apocryphal or deuterocanonical books at all. So what do we do with this? Well, the Anglican Church chose to take a position that they recognize the value of these books, though they don't give them, the Anglican Church doesn't give them the same weight as the other 66 books in the Bible. So reading the book of Sirach, for example, enables us to understand more of what Jews were thinking of the time, and it helps influence how we understand what the New Testament has to say. You see, here's something about these apocryphal books. They were written in the period of time between the Old Testament and the New Testament. The last book of the Old Testament, Malachi, traditionally the end of the Hebrew Bible, was written around 400 BCE. And of course, the New Testament opens up with the Gospels and the life of Jesus about, well, we usually go with the year zero. Didn't really happen then, but probably 4 BCE. But nevertheless, there's about a 400-year span where we don't have the things that are traditionally called scripture by Protestants. But the Jews didn't stop writing things down. They didn't stop contemplating what they had learned from before. They didn't stop thinking about the Torah and how it applies to them. And so a number of books were written in this period of time, and that's where the Apocrypha comes from. And so the book of Sirach is a book about wisdom. It is carrying on the wisdom tradition of the Hebrew Bible. And so there is something for us to learn from it, even if we don't see it in the same way as the other scriptural passages. So having said that, what was it that we heard from Sirach this morning? Well, as I just mentioned to you, we heard a continuation of the wisdom tradition in the Hebrew Bible. The 39 books of the Old Testament contain a great number of genres of literature, and a number of these are wise sayings. Perhaps the key beginning of this tradition was with King Solomon. You might recall that King Solomon was one who was given the opportunity to ask for anything from God, whatever he would like, fame, riches, whatever, and he chose wisdom. And God complimented him for making such a wise choice. And as a result, Solomon became known for his wisdom all around the known world. He began to say things that had a profundity associated with them, and these were collected into a book called Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 8 in particular highlights for us the importance of the pursuit of wisdom. Wisdom is personified in chapter 8, and it is spoken of as though wisdom was calling out to Israel, calling out to the people of Jerusalem, saying, "I'm right here among you, I'm standing at your street corners, when are you going to pay attention to me?" And what we find in the wisdom tradition of the Old Testament is that this idea of the pursuit of wisdom was huge. It was absolutely important. It was vital. It was the thing to be looking for. And so whether you're reading Psalms or Proverbs or Ecclesiastes or the Song of Songs, all of it falls under that category. The pursuit of wisdom, the understanding of the importance of wisdom, was a very significant theme for the ancient Israelites. And this understanding continued during this intertestamental period that I just described. And so a man named Joshua ben Sira, Joshua the son of Sira, and this is where we get the name Sirach for short, continued that contemplation. Whoever the author actually was, he carried on with those thoughts and wrote again about wisdom. And in chapter 24, which is what we heard this morning, he once again wrote of wisdom being personified as a female in this case, Lady Wisdom, she is sometimes referred to. And here wisdom is being described as being something that was there at the beginning with God. That wisdom was actually part of the creative process. It was a wisdom came from the very mouth of God. And in the teaching of Sirach, we find being delivered to its Jewish audience this understanding that wisdom was not only essential and important, and not only was wisdom personified as it was in Proverbs chapter 8, but even more than that, there was an anticipation that wisdom might even be embodied somehow. It would reside in Jerusalem. It would set up shop, as it were, in the capital city of the Israelites. And so what we learn from this passage is this understanding of wisdom was continuing to be developed over those years. And when Jesus arrives, when the first Christmas comes, we start to see this theme of wisdom continuing on throughout his life. We are told when he is very young that Jesus grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and people. It's said on a couple of occasions that he continued to grow and develop in wisdom. Even at the age of 12, we see him answering with wisdom to the teachers in the temple. And then when he begins his ministry and begins to talk about the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven, and the things that he would do, wisdom would always be part of the package. His famous Sermon on the Mount, you could say, would be an extension of the wisdom tradition of the Old Testament. He would say, "You have heard that it was said, but I say to you," and what he would have to say would take everything to another level beyond what had been understood before. When Jesus would be criticized about the things that he did and said, sometimes he would answer by saying, "Look, wisdom is proved right by her actions." So he's making an appeal to wisdom as justification for what he was doing. What we find in the incarnation, what we find in Jesus, the Jewish Messiah, having arrived and doing what he did and saying what he said, we see him becoming the very embodiment of this wisdom that is so often spoken of in the Hebrew Bible and in the Hebrew intertestamental literature. Jesus, it can be seen, and certainly was seen by his apostles, by his other disciples, that Jesus was indeed the understandable fulfillment of all that was being spoken of in the Hebrew Bible. And so their thought, whether we're talking the 12 apostles or the women who were following with Jesus, or even the apostle Paul later in all of their preaching and instruction, to them was they would speak to a Jewish audience, their thought was, this makes total sense. This is what Jesus is doing. He's completing and fulfilling these things that we have been contemplating for some time. Now, obviously, not all Jews saw it that way. And to this day, not all Jews see it that way. But we can see that from the very beginning, these other Jewish men and women understood Jesus to be the fulfillment of this concept of wisdom that they were to pursue. And so Christmas makes sense in that way. Jesus makes sense in that Jewish context. Now, my opening question this morning had to do with what difference Christmas makes for everybody else. Having contemplated what I just said, we could see, oh, okay, you know, Jesus, this Palestinian Jew, is born in Bethlehem and he does his thing in Israel, and then he does these amazing things and says he's amazing. It makes sense that, okay, we can see how Jesus connects the dots there for the Jews. But we still have that question, how on earth does Jesus connect any dots whatsoever for everybody else? Well, this is where our second reading comes into place. The Apostle John, whose name is put on this book, we don't know if the Apostle John wrote all of this himself or if there were some followers of his. It kind of doesn't matter. Let's just call him John for now. He opens his gospel using something called a prologue that has remarkable parallels to Sirach 24. But whereas Sirach 24 is talking about wisdom, John is talking about something else. You might recall the first words. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Well, what's that all about? Well, the word there that is translated word is this Greek word called logos. And what John is doing in this prologue, following the pattern of Sirach 24 and talking about wisdom, he is now using a similar form to talk about this thing called logos. Logos was a Greek philosophical concept that emerged with a guy named Heraclitus in about 500 BCE. And then after him, this concept was continued to be developed and thought about by Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics. By the time Jesus comes around, there has been quite a concept about logos and what it means. So now, what does logos mean? Well, it certainly means word, which is the way it's translated in the Gospel of John, but that is an insufficient definition. There's so much more there. The idea of the logos is that the logos would be the ground of being for all things. It could be translated the reason behind something, the word that is spoken certainly. It is the essence of what is. To put it in another way, if you were to recognize something as being blue, the logos would be the blueness of the blue, if that makes sense. Or to look at it another way, if you've got a dog over here, the dogginess of the dog is its logos. What is it that makes a dog beyond the fact that it has a physiological structure of a certain way? So logos has to do with the essence of things. This is what the Greeks were thinking about. This is where they were going in their philosophical thought. Now understand, this Greek philosophical approach is being done completely outside of Judaism. It is being conducted completely outside of any notion of the Torah or the knowledge of Yahweh, the God of Israel. Anything that is being revealed about God to the Jews is not really at the fingertips of these Greek philosophers. And yet they come upon a concept that actually, well, there's something to be said for that. This idea of there being this essence of being at creation. The Greeks would go on to say that the logos was not only present with the divine, but indeed was a mechanism by which things were put into place. That the logos was indeed something that not only accounts for the nature of things, but continues to uphold things and inspire things and cause life of things to happen. By the time John writes his gospel, about 70 years have passed in the life of Jesus. And by this time, the gospel message is going out to far more people than just Jews, but is going out to Gentiles as well. Some translations of the Bible refer to them as the Greeks. The Greek culture was so pervasive then, even under the Roman Empire, Greek philosophy and culture was huge. And so the idea was that there were two kinds of people in the world, those who were Jewish and those who were not. There were Jews and Greeks, Jews and Gentiles. And now the church is going out to speak to people who are not Jews. And so in his account of the gospel of Jesus Christ, John chooses to take this well-known Greek concept of the Logos and attach that understanding to who Jesus is. So that just as Jesus is the fulfillment of the Jewish concept of wisdom, according to Sirach in Proverbs 8, so also he is the fulfillment of the Greek concept of the Logos. By doing this, John builds a bridge for the presentation of the gospel to people who have no concept of a Jewish perspective on life. And to this day, we find that the gospel of Jesus Christ is still applicable to all people, regardless of their proximity to any understanding of Judaism. It certainly helps to understand the Hebrew Bible. It certainly makes it easier for us to understand more of what Jesus was saying and doing when we have some knowledge of the Hebrew Bible. But what we see happening with John is this illustration of something that I think is a very pervasive concept we need to understand in the world today. The Bible tells us that all human beings are created in the image of God. And because of that, I'm convinced that all peoples have this natural inclination to understand the divine, to understand the other, the more. There's a number of ways to try to describe that. And you will still see to this day that the majority of the people on the planet have this religious concept, this idea that there's something else out there, that there's some kind of spiritual realm or what have you. I'm convinced that that natural inclination is part of the indication that we have been created in God's image. And so as a result, and the Apostle Paul refers to this in Acts chapter 17, all human beings have this tendency to try to seek after God, even to grope after God, hoping that they might find God. And so what that means then is all human efforts to understand God, we ought to understand that there will be something to be said for all of them. That people will be hitting upon something. People will be grabbing a concept that actually makes sense, that fits. Just as the Greek concept of Logos does not appear in the Hebrew Bible at all, and even though Heraclitus and those that came after him were contemplating this outside of any revelation of God, the God of Israel, Yahweh, they nevertheless were onto something. And John is able to say, guess what? You're on the right track, and let me show you how Jesus fulfills what it is that you've begun to understand. What I'm suggesting to you is this. If there was a gospel being written to the Chinese of Jesus' day, or to the First Nations of Jesus' day, it wouldn't surprise me at all if those gospels would begin from the context of that Chinese thought or that North American First Nations thought, and basically say, you're onto something here. Let me show you how Jesus fulfills what you've already come to understand. Yes, there is a great spirit who has put all things together. There is that circle of life of which we take part. But when Jesus showed up, albeit in this tiny area of the world called Palestine, he brought about something that embodies what it is that people are exploring and seeking to know about the divine. And so now, even today, as people contemplate the supernatural, the divine, the other, the more, we can point them to Jesus and say, I think you're on the right track. Let me show you how Jesus embodies some of those things you've been talking about. Christmas really is a season that is for all people and for all the world. And even though it might at first blush seem strange that this baby that comes out of nowhere and shows up in this backwoods town in this tiny corner of the world, he nevertheless becomes the one who can speak to all people as they are trying to understand who is the one who has made them, who is the one that is responsible for life, how is it that we have come to be who we are, and where do we go from here with that? We can turn to Jesus. We can look to the baby in the manger, who grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and people, who not only embodied the whole Jewish wisdom contemplation, but also showed himself to be the essence of all life, the one present at creation, through whom all things were made. So on this second Sunday after Christmas, this 10th day of the Christmas season, let us let those thoughts roll around in our minds. And may we consider how we can watch for how Jesus is the embodiment of things that people around us have come to understand about the divine. Let us invite them to consider Jesus and what he has done and what he has said to bring about a fulfillment, a completion, at the very least adding something to what they've already come to know. That the knowledge of the divine, the knowledge of the holy, will increasingly be theirs, just as we have come to know him ourselves. Amen.